Good morning and welcome to another exciting episode of Video Nasties. My name is Maxwell Haddad. Thank you for listening. It's just past 9:30 a.m. on Thursday, December 8th, 2022. I'm here in my living room recording studio as opposed to my basement studio or my outdoor studio. Although it has warmed up today, the sun's out. It was a rainy day yesterday. It was raining all day. But I like having a rainy day every once in a while, especially when it's followed by some sun. So here I am. I've got my coffee. I've got my notes in front of me. And I'm ready to talk to you fine people about Amsterdam, which is the new movie by David O. Russell, now available for streaming on HBO Max. Yes, this is the Margot Robbie movie I was referring to in yesterday's episode. Some of you may have guessed that this would indeed be the film that I would be reviewing today. So just give me one moment, please, as I sip my coffee. And here we go. So I'm going to be going off the cuff and reading from my notes. So it's going to be both. Just so you know. Sorry, I just want to kind of get set up here. So I've been a David O. Russell fan for a number of years now. The first one I saw was Flirting with Disaster, which my mom is actually a big fan of, and she kept talking about this movie and kept insisting that I watch it. So eventually I watched it with her, and I loved it. I mean, I was laughing out loud. I was cracking up, especially at the end, the dinner scene with the brother is just like, to me, it's like a classic scene in comedy. I'd heard of Spanking the Monkey, which is part of the American independent new wave movement of the 1990s, which I'm a huge fan of and am hugely influenced by. I still, to this day, have never seen Spanking the Monkey. I believe it was a Sundance movie. It was kind of the breakout Sundance movie of that year. So he's part, David O. Russell is really part of that, part of that group of filmmakers that includes Paul Thomas Anderson, Quentin Tarantino, Richard Linklater, Robert Rodriguez, Steven Soderbergh, and then a little later on, Darren Aronofsky and Christopher Nolan. Also Tom DeSillo, who I believe is his name, Tom DeSillo, who I believe made Living in Oblivion and In the Soup. He's one of the sort of the less successful of this group. Oh, also Wes Anderson with Bottle Rocket. The kind of, and then Kevin Smith, but the Tom DeSillo kind of fell by the wayside. Allison Anders, I think, had a similar fate, but she was part of this school. So I do include David O. Russell in this group. He's almost like the Peter Bogdanovich of the group or something, where he's like not officially, like Peter Bogdanovich was not officially a member of New Hollywood, but I consider him to be a member of New Hollywood. The David O. Russell is not officially a part of the new American independent cinema, but I consider him to be a part of the new American independent cinema. Or maybe he is. I don't know. This is all kind of unofficial anyway, except, well, it's not, I shouldn't say it's all unofficial. There definitely was an American independent, cinema movement in the 90s. And, you know, Tarantino, Linklater, Robert Rodriguez, a little later, Paul Thomas Anderson. I guess if you want to say that there were official members, they were official members. So I guess you could say that some of this is official. Anyway, he later went on to make, I don't think I'm forgetting one. I believe it was Spanking the Monkey, Flirting with Disaster, and then I Heart Huckabees. Right? Am I forgetting one? I don't know. So then I Heart Huckabees is, a lot of people love that movie. I mean, I liked it okay when I saw it. I didn't really get it. I was pretty young. I was 14 when it came out. So that was like the new David O. Russell movie to me. And I didn't like it nearly as much as Flirting with Disaster. And I still don't like it that much. I have some issues with it. I love Jason Schwartzman. And I actually like Mark Wahlberg's performance in that movie. It's one of his better performances. I like Dustin Hoffman and Lily Tomlin in it okay. Jude Law, Naomi Watts. It's got an interesting cast. I don't know. It's not really for me. Maybe I would like it more if I watched it now. Oh, I think Isabelle Huppert is in it, right? Doesn't Jason Schwartzman fuck her in one scene? That scene put me off, too, when they're, like, humping in the dirt or something. I was just kind of like, oh, I don't know. This just isn't for me. So, maybe I would like it if I watched, like it more if I watched it again. And then I Heart Huckabees is now primarily known for the YouTube clip where David O. Russell is freaking out, losing his mind, screaming at Lily Tomlin, calling her a bitch. This kind of behind-the-scenes clip that came out. So, I mean, that did spoil David O. Russell's name. It ruined David O. Russell for me to a certain extent. I mean, it's not a surprise that the guy's an asshole. I mean, most people in Hollywood are assholes. So I wasn't surprised by it at all. But it just leaves a bad taste in your mouth. And I just could never quite see David O. Russell the same way again. I still respect him as a filmmaker. I still love Flirting with Disaster. That's the only movie of his that I love. But interestingly, after I Heart Huckabees, his career completely changed. I don't know when that clip came out on YouTube. I want to say it was after the career transition, but I'm not exactly sure. So with The Fighter in 2010, he had a career transition, and he completely kind of rehauled his filmmaking style, and he became a very different filmmaker. So he was no longer the loose, weird, comedic David O. Russell. He just wanted to make a good movie. I think I'm trying to remember where I heard this talked about. I feel like it was Tarantino and maybe Tarantino and Avery on Video Archives. I don't know. Maybe I just always go back to Tarantino for everything. But I feel like I heard somebody talk about this, and it's like I was just like, that's perfect. That's a perfect way to describe it. Like after I Heart Huckabees, you know, a few years passed, and he just said, I just want to make a good movie, and that's what The Fighter is. So in some ways, I think this was a loss because we kind of lost the David O. Russell style, which was sort of absurdist, that's the thing I like best about David O. Russell is that he is an absurdist, and he does bring this back a bit for Amsterdam, which I'll get to. There is an element of absurdism to Amsterdam that I really appreciated, and which has been absent from his style. He just, for a while there, it just seemed he wanted to make good movies, and he made more straightforward movies for a while. So he made The Fighter, then he made Silver Linings Playbook, both of which I still have not seen to this day. And those are his two like biggest movies, biggest hits, most well-known movies. So it's sort of ironic that those are the only two I haven't seen, besides his first movie, Smacking the Monkey, which is a bit more obscure. It's a bit harder to see these days, although I'm sure you can find it streaming. Okay, so then he gets into American Hustle, which I did see in a theater. I believe that's the only David O. Russell movie that I've seen in a theater, is American Hustle. I did enjoy it. That was kind of a weird day for me. I actually snuck into it, I think. Or did I buy a ticket? I don't remember. But I had a double feature of The Great Beauty by Paolo Sorrentino, which I didn't like as much as I thought I would. And then right from there, I went into American Hustle by David O. Russell, which I liked more than I thought I would. So it was an interesting double feature. I do think The Great Beauty is the superior movie of the two. I don't really like either movie that much, though. There are things I like about American Hustle. I like the time period, and I like some things about Jennifer Lawrence's performance and Christian Bale's performance. Okay, anyway, so the next movie he made was Joy. So Joy completed the David O. Russell, Jennifer Lawrence trilogy, as I like to call it. So they had an interesting working relationship where they made three movies together. Again, Silver Linings Playbook, American Hustle, and Joy. Joy being by far the least successful of the three, both commercially and creatively. I haven't seen Silver Linings Playbook, so I can't really speak on that, but it's my understanding that it was. Oh, Bradley Cooper. Okay, so he was in Silver Linings Playbook and American Hustle. Who's the other woman in American Hustle? I can't even remember now. Oh, Amy Adams. Amy Adams, yeah, who I don't really like. But and she was maybe a little miscast in that, in American Hustle. I want to say that Amy Adams is often miscast, but I don't know if that's actually true. What happened to Amy Adams? She hasn't been in anything in a while. After Arrival, I feel like she kind of fell off the face of the planet a little bit. Perhaps for the better. Maybe she's doing television now, I'm not sure. Anyway, so that's it. After Joy, David O. Russell, so he was banging out movies for a while. The Fighter, 2010. Silver Linings Playbook, 2012. American Hustle, the next fucking year, 2013. And then Joy, a few years later, 2016. I believe I have my dates right. So in 2010s, he was killing it. Especially early 2010s. I think The Fighter and Silver Linings, like I said, are his two biggest hits. And then he did one of his David O. Russell disappearing acts for 6 years. He didn't make anything for 6 years, I believe, unless I'm, again, forgetting another one. So from Joy 2016 to this year, 2022 with Amsterdam, he didn't make anything. And now he's back with Amsterdam. And I'll just say right off the bat, I really liked this movie. I was impressed by this movie. I think it's better than all of the movies that I just mentioned. I think it's his best movie since Flirting with Disaster. I'm really going out on a limb and saying that. It didn't stay with me as much as I thought I would. That's definitely a big... it's not a big factor for me, but it's a way that I look at movies and judge movies is like, if I'm thinking about it the next morning, and I'm still kind of feeling it, and I'm still kind of in the world of the movie, then that's big for me. And I was thinking about it this morning, but not as much as I would have liked to, or as I would be with a movie that I liked more. And I wasn't really feeling it, wasn't really still in that world. It kind of ended up being a bit more, I don't know, I guess maybe disposable than I thought it would be. But... again, I was thinking about it a bit this morning. So, also, I really hope this audio is coming out, because I'm just remembering that last time it got fucked in the living room. Okay. The audio's good. I just checked it. So, moving on. Sorry for the brief pause there. So, David O. Russell. Right, so as I mentioned earlier, he brought back some of his absurdism for this movie, which had been missing. I mean, really, I guess there's a little bit of it in American Hustle with Jennifer Lawrence kind of freaking out in her house. And Silver Linings Playbook, I guess, is like partly a comedy. See, I haven't seen it, so I can't speak on it. The Fighter, I think, is pretty, like, straightforward. Christian Bale is another one of his guys, his actors. Appears in The Fighter, American Hustle, and this, Amsterdam. And then Joy is kind of like a weird fake biopic. I like Joy okay up until the end. I thought the end was, like, a bit goofy and borderline ridiculous, the very end of the movie. Up until that, it was okay. I don't really remember much from it. It's kind of forgettable. Maybe Amsterdam will be too. I'm not sure. But right now, I'm still, you know, it's still fresh in my mind. So I'm going to get into some of the notes I wrote for it. But I will say now that, or right away, that Amsterdam is one of my top movies of the year right now, so far, 2022. And I say so far, I mean, the year is coming to an end. It's coming to a close. We're in the last month of the year, obviously. But I kind of, when I say so far, I kind of mean like so far for my viewing, with my viewing. I mean, I have some catching up to do, but I really don't have that much catching up to do. Partly because there just aren't a lot of movies that I want to see from this year. And also because a lot of movies that I do want to see are coming out at the end of the year. Although, no, there are, well, yeah, I mean, there are a couple from earlier that I have to get caught up on. Oh, I just actually thought of another one. I'm keeping a list of all the movies from this year that I have not seen that I want to see. And then I'm also working on my top 10. Right now I have a top 6 for the year. And Amsterdam is part of that top 6. I'm not going to reveal the movies that I have to that I want to see that I have not seen. I am also not going to reveal my top 6. I will do an end of the year wrap up episode of this pod. So look forward to that, hopefully. I also have an honorable mention, which you can, if you've been listening to the last few episodes, you can maybe guess what that is. So what was that? I have the house to myself, which is why I'm able to record in the living room, but I just heard a weird sound. Okay, I'm good. So, just to get into some of my notes here. Oh, and yes, what I wanted to say was that this is my top comedy of the year so far. It's my favorite comedy of the year. Amsterdam for 2022. It is a funny movie. There were some laugh out loud moments. It's also serious. It's also dramatic. There's also some comedy that maybe doesn't quite land. It also does dip into sentimentality a bit too much for my taste, but I was also touched by the movie at times. So, just to jump to something else. So these are my notes. They're going to be a bit scattered. I'll perhaps sound a bit scatterbrained, but this is just kind of what I was thinking about the movie while I was preparing for the podcast this morning. So, Russell has never done plotting to this extent. There is a kind of film noir plot going on in this movie. There's a lot going on in this movie. There are a lot of different threads. There are motifs. There are things that keep being mentioned. But there is also legitimately a plot, and there's also the moment at the end where you find out what you've been seeing isn't quite what you thought that you were seeing, which is another film noir technique. I have this whole thing about like film noir and like film noir plotting where it's like, I'm obsessed with this dense plotting and this idea of like you're watching something and you think you're following it and then you realize that you've been watching something else. I mean, I call it like film noir plotting, but I guess it's just kind of like a storytelling device or storytelling devices. I'm just like, I don't know, it's weird. I'm obsessed with this, but then I'm also obsessed with like the looseness of like French New Wave and then like the Tarantino style of like just following characters and just kind of seeing what they're doing during the day and just hearing their conversations and there really not being a plot going on. There's a story there. Tarantino's a master storyteller. But I don't think he has this obsession with plotting that I seem to have. And yet when I write, I tend to lean more into Tarantino. But I think I should kind of get more into plotting. I don't know. This movie made me think of that. So anyway. He's writing on his own for this one. At least that's how it's credited. I don't know what went on behind the scenes. David O. Russell's a talented writer. He's always written his scripts, but they've been all co-written up to a certain point. I don't think it was The Fighter on. I think American Hustle was co-written. I think Silver Linings Playbook was co-written too. That's based on a novel, though, I think. So I don't know, but he's graduated to solo screenwriting. Some other screenwriters who have done that include, it's weird because I tried to make a list and then I realized it's not actually true. I thought Edgar Wright had, because I think at first, Last Night in Soho was credited only to him, at least like on IMDb or whatever, which, you know, can't be trusted. But then it turns out he co-wrote that too with Christy Wilson Cairns. And then Wes Anderson is getting solo screenwriting credit now, I think, but not solo story credit. And then I also wanted to mention Eli Roth, who co-wrote Cabin Fever, but then wrote Hostel and Hostel Part 2 on his own. Those are both written and directed by Eli Roth, but then he disappeared for a while. And then The Green Inferno, I think was co-written. Yeah, I think it was Nicholas Lopez or I think is the gentleman's name. I'm not sure. So he kind of went back into co-writing. So, but as is the case with, I think Flirting with Disaster, maybe that was solo David O. Russell. Maybe I should have done some more research before I recorded this. Sorry. Hold on, sorry. But with both Edgar Wright and this is a side note, this may actually have nothing to do with what I'm talking about, and I also may have talked about this on the podcast previously. With Edgar Wright and Wes Anderson, they both had their writing partners early on who were also actors in their movies. So Owen Wilson in the case of Wes Anderson, Simon Pegg in the case of Edgar Wright, but then they kind of, whatever, drifted apart or moved away from that, and they both, it's weird that it's a similar trajectory. It's this weirdly similar trajectory where Simon Pegg became like a bigger actor than he was, as did Owen Wilson, obviously. Owen Wilson became like a legitimate movie star, at least for a while, and then he tried to kill himself. Simon Pegg never became a legitimate movie star. And I also think there was an issue with Simon Pegg in terms of like the projects that he chose to do and his taste. I think his taste is off, even though I think he's a great writer and a great actor in those Edgar Wright movies. Anyway, that's a side note. So moving on. This was produced by Drake and Future, the rappers, yes, or the musicians or musical artists, whatever you want to call them. And they may have been executive producers. There may have been other producing credits. But what I saw in the closing credits, if I'm not mistaken, is produced by Drake. And he's credited that way, just Drake. His real name's Aubrey something, I think. And then Future is credited by his real name, that, you know, then with Future in between first and last name in quotes, you know, as like a, you know, credited as like a nickname. So I guess, I don't know, I would like to look into that some more. There is a musical connection, that's one of the threads that runs through the movie. Christian Bale's character loves music, and he often sings with his patients. He's a doctor, it says on his office, I put office in quotes, his kind of makeshift office. It says physician and surgeon. I guess he's a plastic surgeon and he helps. He's a veteran. He helps veterans who have come back from war. I'm trying to kind of like dance around the movie itself, partly because I think people should watch it. I don't think enough people have probably seen this movie or maybe even heard of it. It's one of the best movies of the year, in my opinion. So I think people should watch the movie. And I also don't like to just recount the plot, but I will give you some of the plot, especially as it relates to what I'm talking about next, which first I'll just read from my notes and then I'll go back and maybe give you some plotting. So this is from my notes. Taylor Swift's character is essential. Yes, Taylor Swift is in this movie. So you remember her for the rest, and she's only in the beginning, even though you do see her at the end in flash quick cuts. Quick cuts of flashbacks or cuts to, what would you call it? Recapitulations. You remember her for the rest of the movie because you're like, why is Taylor Swift in this movie? I questioned her casting at first, but that's why it works. Also, she's not a bad actress, as she was previously thought to be. With the right director, she can act. So my point there is, first of all, Taylor Swift can act. She's good in this movie. She's not great, but she's good. And I could tell right off the bat, I thought, oh, okay, so she actually can act. And I also had a moment where I was like, when I first saw her, I was like, is that Taylor Swift? And then I was like, oh, I'm not sure if that's her. I also did watch the trailer for this movie, so she might have been in the trailer, and I might have somewhere in the back of my mind remembered that she was in it. She plays the daughter of a murdered man. So the way this movie starts out is, I mean, first we're introduced to Christian Bale's character, and then we get into the plot part of the movie, and then there's a flashback, and then we get back into the plot of the movie. So that's kind of the structure. The plot of the movie is Taylor Swift's father is murdered. She goes to first John David Washington's character and then Christian Bale's character and hires them to perform an autopsy on her father's body and find the cause of death. So that's the jumping off point. I should also mention this movie stars Christian Bale, John David Washington, and Margot Robbie. They're the core of the movie, the heart of the movie. That trio is the center of the movie, and they are the three stars of the movie. All three of them are good in the movie. Margot Robbie is great. Christian Bale is very good. And John David Washington is good in the movie. I think he works in the movie. I don't think he's miscast. I just don't think he's a very good actor. People might get mad at me for saying that. I think he's a decent actor. This is Denzel Washington's son. I found that out later. His kind of breakout was Tenet. He starred in Tenet, which I thought he was pretty good in some ways better than this movie. He's just like a little flat, a little stiff, a little boring as an actor. I actually don't even like Denzel Washington that much as an actor, although he's great in Tragedy of Macbeth. I think he overacts, kind of the opposite of his son, who I think underacts. But anyway, he does get better as the movie progresses, as it goes on. And I'll get into that in just a moment. Oh, it's my next note. Okay. I questioned John David Washington's acting at first, but he grew into the role, or perhaps his performance grew on me. He's a decent actor. He's not a great actor. I don't even think he's a good actor. I think he's a decent actor. I also want to take back what I said in the previous episode of this podcast. Margot Robbie is a very good actor. Now, she's become a better actress than she was 10 years ago, so that's important to note. I would argue that after her work in Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, this is her greatest performance. She's great in the movie. Whatever kind of like dynamic or chemistry was happening between her and David O. Russell and Christian Bale and John David Washington and Anya Taylor-Joy, which I'll get to in a second, it really works. And, oh, you know what I didn't do? Well, I can do it on the pod. She's really great. She's really a standout in this movie. and she plays a kind of, I don't know what you call them, a war doctor. She's helping the soldiers in France. She's a French girl, you think, at first, and then it turns out she's not actually French. But they meet her during the war, during World War One. They're both, Christian Bale and John David Washington are both soldiers, American soldiers in France during World War One. So that's how they meet Margot Robbie's character. So after the very beginning, which is the introduction, our introduction as the audience to Christian Bale's character, then there's the plot getting kicked off with John David Washington and Taylor Swift's characters. And then there's the flashback. Something else happens in between, but I don't want to even say that. Just because this movie is so new, it just appeared on streaming, and I do want people to watch it. It deserves to be seen. So then there's the flashback, and then it cuts back. So it flashes back to 1919. Then it cuts back to 1933, which is when most of the movie takes place. New York, 1933. So then, so in the flashback is when we're introduced to Margot Robbie's character. Then there's a scene with Christian Bale's character's wife, played by Andrea Riseborough. Great performance, great actress. Then I would argue one of the best actors in the movie and one of the best performances in the movie. Then we are introduced to Rami Malek and Anya Taylor-Joy's characters. First Anya Taylor-Joy, then Rami Malek. Rami Malek plays Margot Robbie's brother, and Anya Taylor-Joy plays his wife. Now, before Anya Taylor-Joy appeared in the movie, Margot Robbie's character was my favorite character in the movie, and her performance was my favorite performance in the movie. But it soon switched over to Anya Taylor-Joy. She stole the show from me. She took over the movie. She's amazing. I do have a thing for Anya Taylor-Joy. I love her. I think she's like the opposite of Simon Pegg. Her taste is impeccable. I think every movie she's been in is good. I haven't seen The Menu, but every movie that I've seen her in has been a good movie, and she's been, if not a great movie, and she's been great in it. I love her work with Robert Eggers. I love her in Split. I love her in Thoroughbreds. I think that's her at her hottest. I do have an attraction to her, but it's not just that. I think she's a genuinely interesting actress. So, Anya Taylor-Joy delivers my favorite performance in the movie. She also plays my favorite character, and my favorite dynamic in the film is between her and Margot Robbie's character. I love how she chides her. I also couldn't help but imagine a threesome with them this morning. Okay, so yeah, there is a sexual element. Goddess level. That threesome would be goddess level. But besides the threesome, yeah, I love how she's always, she treats Margot Robbie's character like a patient, because Margot Robbie is living in their house. Rami Malek plays this rich guy. He has this mansion. His sister, and Rami Malek's great in the movie too. His sister is Margot Robbie's character, and she's not well. She has vertigo. And he and Anya Taylor-Joy's character kind of taking care of her. I guess Anya Taylor-Joy's character is sort of like her nurse in a way, and she's always telling her, oh, you know, don't do this, you know, kind of like keeping her in check. And it was just like that dynamic was just like very funny to me, and just also interesting and fun. I don't know, just seeing the two women kind of going back and forth in a way. It's more like Margot Robbie would kind of push forward and Anya Taylor-Joy would kind of pull her back. Yes, there is a hotness element, but it's not just that. It's an interesting dynamic. So I was just reminded, just thinking about Rami Malek's performance in the movie. My favorite scene in the entire movie happens at the end where they're putting the eye drops in their eyes. That's all I'm going to say about the movie. I mean, about the scene. But I think there was a clip from that scene in the trailer, unless there was like a clip from the movie that came out early and it had that scene in it, and it was a clip from that scene. I don't know. I know I'd seen part of that scene before. It might have just been in the trailer. I also want to mention the cinematography in this. I think it's the most beautifully shot of David O. Russell's films. I think it's the most lushly shot of his movies, if that's even proper English, lushly shot. I think he definitely could have gone bigger. There could have been these crazy shots of Amsterdam and New York, like crazy exteriors. I mean, that would have, you know, it would have to all have been period, either dressed or done in a computer. It would have cost more money. I mean, I'm sure he had plenty of money to make this, but I mean, with that cast, he must have. But I think he chose to go for the more intimate angle and to really have close-ups of his actors, and a lot of it is interiors. And I think this was all very intentional. And he does shoot a lot handheld. But I do think the cinematography was beautiful. I really do. You could argue that this is an example of an intimate epic. I wouldn't quite go that far, but this is something else I'm obsessed with in film. I first heard it talked about by Quentin Tarantino. And I would argue that Pulp Fiction is an intimate epic, but he was talking about, a long time ago, he was in this Robert De Niro documentary, and I guess is what it was, and he was talking about The Deer Hunter, which I think is a masterpiece. And he says that it achieves, or it accomplishes, or it's an example of one of the most difficult things to do in cinema, which is an intimate epic. And I totally agree. And that's kind of like my baseline for intimate epics, or my kind of like go-to reference point for intimate epics is The Deer Hunter. I'm sure I've mentioned some of this on the pod before. So that's actually going to wrap up my Babylon. I keep wanting to call it Babylon. Fuck me. Another Margot Robbie movie from this year. Period piece. With a one-word title. It's Amsterdam, motherfuckers, to quote Hostel. That's pretty much going to wrap up the discussion. I'm just going to pull up IMDb real quick, which, of course, anyone listening can do. But I just want to... First, I want to double-check the cinematographer. I believe it's... not Laszlo Kovacs. Janusz Kaminski, I think, shot it. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Emmanuel Lubezki. Oops. Yeah, I love the cinematography here. It is digital, if I'm not mistaken. And I'm also going to double-check that. And where this movie goes is, it is very unexpected. Yeah, they had $80 million to make this movie. So, yeah, I mean, he... O'Russell could pretty much do what he wanted. And he chose to do it this way, to shoot it this way, to make it this way, to approach it this way. Yeah, it's digital. So, I just want to go down the cast list, because this is... maybe the best cast of the year, the most stacked cast of the year. I mean, it's right on the fucking poster, so I don't even need to read it to you, but I will, nonetheless. Christian Bale, Margot Robbie, John David Washington, Chris Rock, Anya Taylor-Joy, Zoe Saldana, Mike Myers, Michael Shannon, Timothy Olyphant, Andrea Riseborough, Taylor Swift, Matthias Schoenaerts, Alessandro Nivola, Rami Malek, and Robert De Niro. That's all you need to know. Amsterdam. Okay, so while that does wrap up the main part of the episode, I do want to also talk about another movie, which was the other movie that I watched last night. I was pretty knocked out by Amsterdam, so I needed a little break. So I took an hour and I read From Hell by Alan Moore, which I want to talk about briefly, and I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't read the book or seen the Johnny Depp and Heather Graham movie version, but I just thought this was... While that does wrap up the main part of the episode, I want to talk about the other movie that I watched last night. So after watching Amsterdam, I was pretty knocked out. Or I should say I was knocked out by Amsterdam, and I needed some time, so I read for an hour. And what I read was Alan Moore's From Hell, the graphic novel. Now, I don't want to spoil it. I don't want to ruin it for anyone who hasn't read the book or seen the Johnny Depp and Heather Graham movie version. But in the book, Alan Moore, and the book is just getting more and more interesting as it goes on. And this is from the part that I just read. Something has been revealed. We already know who the killer is. He's this doctor. But what's really making things interesting for me is this, what I'm about to read from my notes. And by the way, I just recorded, and then somebody was calling me, and I answered the call, and it deleted the recording for some reason, so fuck you, Anchor. So I just had to re-record it, so I apologize if that sounded a little awkward. This is from my notes. Alan Moore posits in From Hell that Jack the Ripper was a media creation or a creation of the media, and that the From Hell letters were written by a journalist, or journalists, a team of two journalists, a pair of journalists, I should say. So this was really interesting to me because I have studied Jack the Ripper a bit, and I have on Wikipedia at one point, I don't know if it's still up on there, maybe it is, it probably is, I read one of the From Hell letters, the one about, I guess, frying a prostitute's organ and eating it. Jack the Ripper was not only is he the first serial killer, but he was the first killer to send letters to the press, to authorities. Now, if you go with Alan Moore's theory or what he posits in the book, it wasn't actually him writing the letters, it was actually journalists who were concocting this. And who also gave him the name Jack the Ripper, but he signed all the letters From Hell. It said sincerely. I think it says sincerely yours, maybe Jack the Ripper, and then under that From Hell, and that's all how all the letters ended. And I always found that chilling. So that's From Hell, and then the other movie I watched. I'm probably gonna have to help with groceries in a moment, so I am speeding through this a little bit. The other movie I watched was Shiver of the Vampires, or The Shiver of the Vampires. The French title is Les Frissons des Los Vampires, Vampiros, whatever it is. I just threw a little Spanish in there. But I like frisson. I've heard that word before, and I thought it meant like burn, but it actually means shiver, I guess, is a translation of it. So this is an interesting... I guess early Jean Roland movie, 1971, which is a full 10 years before The Escapees and Zombie Lake, which are the other two Jean Roland movies that I previously talked about on this pod and reviewed on this pod. I'm kind of on a Jean Roland kick. I'm pretty into him right now. I, at some point, need to sign up for Criterion Channel for another month, if only to watch The Living Dead Girl. Because I need to see that movie. I have the feeling that that'll be kind of the quintessential Jean Roland movie. As far as Shiver of the Vampires, I liked it. I didn't love it. I really liked the scene with when the two vampires come back and have dinner with the young couple who are honeymooning. I guess it's the woman's brother owns this castle that they're in, and I get the feeling from watching this movie that Jean Roland and his kind of troupe of actors got access to this castle, and they used the shit out of it. And then they also used this graveyard. I mean, the whole movie basically takes place in two locations, besides some of the car stuff when the couple is driving in. It's basically the graveyard and then the castle, mostly in the castle, which is a really cool setting for a movie. So from my notes, Shiver of the Vampires, it's psychedelic. It definitely has this late 60s or early 70s kind of psychedelic vibe. I guess maybe not late, more just like a 60s psychedelia thrown into like a horror vampire movie, which is cool. It creates an interesting flavor. I like the costumes. They definitely looked kind of 70s to me, especially the two servants, I guess is how they're referred to, the two women who live in the castle. And we see them naked. We see this kind of like, I don't know if she's like an ancient vampire. We see her naked, and we also see the newlywed wife naked, and she looks super hot in one scene where they're at dinner and her hair is kind of done up and she's in this kind of busty revealing top where you kind of see the sides of her tits. It's great. It's a glorious moment. I believe that is the dinner scene that I just referred to. There's also this crazy score by a French group, I believe, whose name I'm forgetting. I love the opening credit music. I would love to actually like somehow license that music and use it in one of my projects. It's like weird, almost like 60s garage rock meets like a horror movie score. It's almost like Black Sabbath, but like more psychedelic or something, with maybe some garage rock thrown in. That's kind of what the score is like, Black Sabbath, but more psychedelic. So I also want to talk about the set design. There were these weird artifacts in the castle that actually reminded me of Werner Herzog's Nosferatu the Vampire, which was, I believe, released the following year. So this was indeed before Herzog's version of Nosferatu. But if you've seen that version, and I've seen it, I guess, twice at this point, maybe three times. I think three times at this point I've seen Herzog's Nosferatu. It's my favorite Herzog movie. And he's got all these weird little artifacts and these weird little, like, pygmy, mummy-looking things kind of throughout the movie. I mean, right in the opening shots, you see some of them. But in this movie, you only see, like, a few of them. And they're kind of just, like, there in the background at first. But then there's, like, a close-up of them later in the kind of, like, weird, chilly, stone-walled dining room where the previously mentioned dinner scene takes place. They're there in that room, and I don't know, it just reminded me of Herzog's Nosferatu. You also see the bedrooms, but no kind of weirdness there, just kind of like these kind of like, I don't know, ornate looking bedrooms. Or ornate bedrooms. They kind of look cozy, actually. Roland was definitely not a minimalist. He was more of a maximalist. And this movie is very visual. There are long stretches without any dialogue, even though I like the dialogue. I like it a lot in that dinner scene, particularly. But a lot of it is told visually. A lot of it is like women kind of drifting, walking slowly. Weird music happening, weird lighting happening, weird costumes being worn. The whole thing is very Roland, very Jean Roland. He's very much an auteur, very much has his own style, his own way of shooting. This style, oh shit, Roland's style was apparent even from the early days. There are kind of these 360 shots that happen once in a while. I think maybe there were only like two of them, or maybe even only one. There was a notable one early on when the young newlywed couple first arrive at the castle. There's a shot with them and the two servants where the camera just keeps turning around, and it's kind of shot from a low angle. And each time it arrives on a character, they speak their line. And one of the servants, the blonde girl, looks like she's going to laugh at the end of each line. I feel like the dude was, like, making her laugh, or maybe she was embarrassed from the close-up. I don't know. It was a memorable shot in the movie. Now, having said that, I want to apologize for what you've just heard. I know it was repetitive. What happened was the recording got fucked up. Now, I was able to salvage most of it, but apparently if I get a call while I'm recording, and this is another reason why I need a better setup, I need like an actual mic, and I need to buy an external hard drive, I need to buy more equipment. But right now I'm recording on my phone, and I mean, I'm happy that it's all being stored on there. I'm happy with the Anchor app in some ways. In other ways, I'm not happy with it at all. Apparently, if I get a call while I'm recording, it fucks up the audio. It stops recording, and I lose, like, the last few seconds of what I recorded. And when I say few seconds, it could be, like, a good 30 seconds of it. I think it is, like, a good 30 seconds of it. So, I'm a little pissed off right now. You're maybe a little disoriented as the listener. You might be thinking, why did I just hear the same thing over again? I wanted to throw it all in there just so I guess maybe I don't need the shorter version. Sorry, this is behind the scenes stuff. I'm just thinking about it as I'm recording. Anyway, I'm gonna futz with it a little more, and hopefully it turns out okay. But I want to say thank you for listening. This has been the Amsterdam episode with some nuggets on From Hell by Alan Moore and on Shiver of the Vampires by Jean Rollin. Talk to you soon. Peace. Okay, so I just wanted to add something briefly. And again, anyone can look this up. But I just hopped on IMDb and looked up Jean Rollin just to check the French title. But what I discovered was, first of all, there are some dope psychedelic posters for the early Jean Rollin movies that you should definitely check out. You can see them on IMDb. Also, I got the feeling that Jean Rollin directed a lot of movies, and he does have 52 credits on IMDb, so he did direct a number of movies. Definitely had his own style. Definitely was an auteur, as I said. You can watch a number of these movies on Arrow Streaming. You can watch The Living Dead Girl on Criterion Channel. The psychedelic posters were only for the early Jean Rollin movies. I think my favorite one is Rape of the Vampire in terms of the poster. That is a dope fucking poster. I would love to have that hanging on my wall framed. So I guess he kind of had this initial trilogy, The Rape of the Vampire, The Nude Vampire, and The Shiver of the Vampires. So this was actually the third in this trilogy. I believe those are his first three movies. I believe he only made shorts before that. He has one called The Sailor's Journey, which is an hour 10. Anyway, so 1968. So he started late 60s. And then Requiem for a Vampire was 72, perhaps, so maybe it wasn't a trilogy, maybe it was four. And then he gets into kind of some other stuff later on, but those are his initial vampire movies. And I think he may have even made pornography. There's one called Hard Penetration. I'm not sure. He definitely made he made a movie called School Hitchhikers, maybe kind of like a nudie movie, softcore pornography, perhaps. Anyway, interesting guy, interesting career. Check out those dope posters for his first three movies, or his kind of initial vampire trilogy. He did die in 2010. Age 72, so I was right about that. I know I watched Rape of the Vampire at one point, or I started it, because I wanted to watch his movies in order. I used to be, like, really into that, watching things chronologically. That isn't as important to me now as it used to be. Now I just kind of want to, I don't know, just watch everything I can, whenever I can, as soon as possible. I just don't feel that I have the time to fuck around anymore that I used to have. So, yeah, I mean, Those are really like The Escapees and Zombie Lake are really later Jean Reno movies. Something interesting on Arrow. I want to double check. They have these Jean Reno collections, and Zombie. They also have Zombie Lake, but it's not part of one of the collections, which was strange to me. I want to make sure it was even directed by Jean Reno. I mean, I know it was. Yeah, Zombie Lake, Night of the Hunted, 1980. I don't know what that is, but yeah, 81. Zombie Lake and The Escapees, and then 82, The Living Dead Girl. Perhaps the quintessential Jean Reno movie? You'll find out soon on Video Nasties. Thank you for listening. I'm Maxwell Haddad. I won't be on tomorrow. I won't be on this weekend, probably. You probably won't hear from me until next week. I'm working a shorter shift tomorrow, so I may be on. I know I always say that, and then I never am. And then long shifts all weekend, Friday, Saturday. So yeah, you probably won't hear from me until next week, but hopefully I will have exciting things to report, exciting things to talk about. Hopefully this was an exciting episode. So yeah, I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you enjoy next week's episodes. I do enjoy talking about new movies. I don't always do it on the pod. This is Video Nasty, so I like to talk about older movies, I like to talk about exploitation movies, video store movies, VHS culture kind of things, horror stuff. But I do watch new movies, and again, I do enjoy talking about them. And I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Thank you again for listening. I'm Maxwell Haddad. This is Video Nasties. Peace.